This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Our continuing coverage of Election 2020 turns now to Ohio's 2nd Congressional District. It's a seat currently held by Republican Congressman Brad Winstrup. He's looking for his 5th two-year term. Political newcomer Jamie Castle is the Democratic nominee in this race, in a district that stretches from eastern Hamilton County to the rural counties along the Ohio River. I spoke earlier with both Winstrup and Castle. We flipped a coin to determine the order of today's interviews. And here's my conversation with Brad Winstrup. Congressman Brad Winstrup, thank you so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure to have you. So let's talk about the main issue that we're all dealing with all across the world, really, and still, of course, here in this area and your district, the coronavirus pandemic. I'm wondering, right off the bat, if you think any more relief is going to come from this Congress before the election. We've seen some challenges in that respect in recent days and hours.
Yeah, I would hope that there is, but I am not very hopeful that it will happen before the election, unfortunately. There have been many attempts, obviously. The Senate has come up with a bill that was rejected on the Senate side, at least as far as bringing it forward, any further forward. And on the House side, Nancy Pelosi put forward a bill that was put forward just by Democrats, and another bill, and she's been working with Secretary Mnuchin, but it doesn't seem like they're getting there. We do, however, have a discharge petition that I think many of the Democrats were also in favor of. A discharge petition is something when you have a majority of the members sign on to a certain legislation, then that has to be brought to the floor. We're not in session right now, so it's hard to gather those signatures, but there is a strong urge on the part of many of us to make sure that we're helping our small businesses and our families get through this. The Paycheck Protection Program was very popular. We have to do a lot of things to nuance that, and I want to continue to do that so that our businesses can survive and the people can pay their bills as well as their employees. So I hope that we can get something done, but unfortunately, in the political climate that we're in right now, it doesn't look like anything will happen before the election, but I don't give up hope.
Well, we saw the president suggest via Twitter that, look, if you just send me something separate that says I can send $1,200 checks again to the American people, I'd do that. Do you see any movement in that respect?
I haven't heard anything coming forward. I'm sad to say that for too many, there are people that don't want to give the president anything that looks like a win right before the election, a win on behalf of the American people, which I think is a shame. I hope the American people recognize that, because there certainly are things that both sides agree on that we should be able to get done. And when you put poison pills in it, like funding for abortion and things like that, that's not going to fly, and it never will. And they know that. And so that's one of the challenges that we have right now. So I applaud the president for saying, look, I will do this. Would you at least do this and bring that forward, and we'll get the help out to the people who need it.
We're talking to Congressman Brad Winstrup, a Republican from Ohio's 2nd Congressional District. He's up for re-election this year. He faces Democratic challenger Jamie Castle in the election. And so President Trump very recently and may, of course, still be infected with COVID-19. And this comes at a heightened criticism of the way he has talked about the COVID-19 pandemic and the way that he has addressed it. I'm wondering your take on this. Do you think that the president has had a serious position on the serious nature of the pandemic?
Oh, I definitely do, because the president's taking advice from scientists and those in medicine that would be in place and giving the advice regardless of the administration. But what we do know is this: we are in a definite challenge. And I'm speaking now as a doctor in medicine. First of all, this coronavirus is called novel for a reason. It is novel. There's things we thought about it at the beginning, and then we've changed our mind. And we've seen that happen time and time again. And unfortunately, we're learning as we go, because we've never seen anything like this. You know, one of the problems that we face is not getting correct data and getting correct information from China from the beginning. I served on Cincinnati Board of Health, and we had outbreaks of things, nothing like this, of course, but you have to have accurate data if you're going to respond to it appropriately and get some idea. And you just look at how China stopped domestic travel but didn't stop international travel. That, to me, was extremely reckless, and it left us in a tough position from the get-go. But I think that's really impressive that what we have done so far. You know, if you look, we wanted to flatten the curve. We wanted to make sure our hospitals were not overrun. When we realized we needed ventilators, we got them. And now you don't even hear about that. You don't even hear about people necessarily needing ventilators. No shortage along that way. But I think just as important as medicine has developed and has taken care of the patients, which is probably who we should hear from a little bit more of, the ones in the trenches that are taking care of patients, we're seeing it through the president, the medicines that are available and that work. Remdesivir is not new, but we found that it has been working for a lot of patients that have this particular virus. The idea of convalescent plasma has been out there for 100 years. This is not new science. And I started advocating for that back in March. And in April, Hawksworth in Cincinnati started collecting. And it has been used and helped a lot of patients. The other thing that we've discovered is that steroid treatments are very effective. We know that with this virus, there's a strong inflammatory reaction to it. And that's what does damage to the lungs. And the steroids bring that down considerably. We're testing people that have no symptoms. We're testing people that are healthy, and they can go home, isolate. If they test positive, take their temperature. They can use a pulse oximeter on their finger. And a lot of doctors are having their patients do this. And if their oxygen levels in their blood are dropping, then they know that they need to be treated. So the therapeutics have really been amazing. And you've seen the mortality rate since March drop by about 40%. And on the other hand, we are very close to a vaccine without compromising any of the protocols that we use for a vaccine. So a lot of lessons learned in this, and in the future, and hopefully this doesn't happen again, but it does, we're going to be more prepared. We've realized that we have a supply chain problem.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you next, because I saw, Congressman, that you said to Channel 12 here in town, WKRC-TV, recently, just last month, that we do need to be more prepared, or you agreed with a doctor who said we need to be more prepared for the next pandemic. How do we do that?
Well, one is make sure that we're not relying on an adversary like China for our protective equipment. I mean, if you look and you see that the virus came from China, and China controls our supply of protective equipment and has a big control over our pharmaceutical industry, because they are the ones that producing ingredients that we need for our pharmaceuticals or producing them themselves. That's a problem, and it isn't good for our national defense and our national health defense. If someone had told me when I was serving in Iraq as a surgeon that we were relying on China for our protective equipment and for our pharmaceuticals, I would have been flabbergasted. But the fact of the matter is that we were. And so these are things that I think both sides of the aisle agree we have to do better. And I've been working with Defense Logistics, for example, because they're very good at logistics and knowing their supply chain and identifying where we have our highest risk as far as not being able to manufacture ourselves. And so as we've been attempting to bring manufacturing back to this country through tax reform, et cetera, we need to really up our game on that, obviously, create more incentives for manufacturing to be here in the United States and good paying jobs for Americans so that we are protected. And also, though, I want to credit the American people. When we saw companies that changed how they manufacture, you know, Gesture that started making straps for masks, New Balance Shoe Company started making masks. We saw a lot of people step up, making ventilators, making disinfectants. This was really pretty amazing, and it was really nice to see that we were taking a whole nation approach like this. It kind of felt like World War II, where everybody was getting engaged. Unfortunately, through a lot of this, rather than being a huge unifying moment for the United States of America, too much of it has become political. And so we'll continue to learn our lessons and try to mend our every flaw. And, you know, for me, as a physician, as a member of the Doctors Caucus in Congress, I think that we have been incredibly engaged, which is important, especially with Operation Warp Speed, which is really a path forward, a common sense approach where these trials are being done. And they're being done with even higher numbers of patients than what might normally be in a trial. And nothing's going to get approved if it's not proven to be safe and effective. What is different is it's a public-private partnership here with the pharmaceutical industry, allowing us to move faster because of the federal support going into this. And so we can get to these phases faster. And as we go along, if if someone's in phase three right now, 100 million doses are being prepared so that if they are approved, then that we can get it right out to our most vulnerable. But the risk is we may need to just throw it away if it's not approved. But the benefit is we'll be ready to go and then produce another 200 million doses for the rest of America.
We're talking with Brad Winstrup, incumbent Republican congressman of Ohio's 2nd Congressional District. He's up for re-election this year and faces Democratic challenger Jamie Castle. Congressman, this is an election year, of course, and so voters are maybe looking at Brad Winstrup and thinking, what has Brad Winstrup done for me over the past 2 years? What is the case you make to voters in your district specifically about what they can visibly see as something you've contributed over the past couple of terms?
Well, I think you can look immediately right now on what we have done with the CARES Act and that paycheck protection program. That's one thing. But I've been heavily involved being on Armed Services Committee with passing the National Defense Authorization Act and taking care of our military and make sure that our military is provided for. We have many people in our district that although we don't have a base or a post, we have many people that serve or have served, and it's important to them. If you look at the VA reforms, I was chairman of health for VA, and we enacted VA Choice. We enacted the VA Mission Act, which incredibly opened up opportunities and access to care for our veterans, and the VA Accountability Act as well. We've done historic tax reform, which has put more money in the pockets of all of our constituents. We've done criminal justice reform, which I think was huge and well received by the community. We're especially allowing people to have a second chance and not over punishing people for minor violations. We also have passed the Secure Act, which is enabling people to plan for their retirement much more, put more money away for their retirement. And then another local issue exists in Pike County of the district, where there is a nuclear facility built in the 50s that was part of helping us win the Cold War. But it's although it was built quickly and impressively, it's going to take about 40 years for this to be dismantled and make the area safe again. And that is something that we fight for funding for every Congress, and we have been successful in that. But I also am continuing to work on how we manage poverty in the United States. You know, it's very difficult for people that find themselves in poverty, and any one of us could find ourselves in that situation. But you have to go one place for your housing, another place for your nutrition, another place for your health care. And we're really working to bring all of these entities down to a local level where it's more of a streamlined effect. I hear too often from single moms that have kids and they say, well, I got a raise at work, but I can't take it because my kids lose their health care, their Medicaid. That's the wrong answer. We need to have a ability to have a smooth transition for people out of poverty and do that at a local level with somebody working with you that's maybe been to your home or knows you rather than just filing paperwork for Washington, D.C. And we've seen some successes like that in Highland County where there was a temporary program that was similar to that. But we've got to stop these cliffs that prevent people from progressing forward. And I'm very passionate about that. And of course, as a doctor, as you might imagine, I want all patients to have access to care. Firm believer in coverage for pre-existing conditions. I have voted for that many times, and I want to make sure that Americans know that they're going to have access to care. We are lucky to have a country that has programs like Medicaid, which we can improve on considerably, but we have that showing that we want to make sure that people have some access to care. But I want that to be more than a piece of paper. I want that to be access to quality care.
Congressman, we've heard a lot recently about Republicans supporting protections for health insurance patients with pre-existing conditions. And yet there has been a years-long battle against what is commonly referred to as Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, including a current case before the Supreme Court that could wipe that all away. How do you reconcile that difference in position?
Well, I would certainly never want to take away Americans' ability to challenge the constitutionality of any law. And that's what's taking place. So I think you would agree that we should have the rights, as this being our government of the people, to challenge the constitutionality of a law, whether it's local, state, or federal. That is what's taking place. But just to let you know, I have voted for coverage for pre-existing conditions during the debate on the American Health Care Act and since, House Republicans have not only had in that bill, but reiterated their strong support for protections for those with pre-existing health conditions. And that's been over and over. We have put forward resolutions that have not been allowed to come to the floor that said no Americans should lose protections for pre-existing conditions, and that that would be a sense of Congress. That regardless of an unconstitutional law, we're going to enact bipartisan legislation to guarantee affordable health insurance coverage if the Supreme Court decides Obamacare is unconstitutional. That has been rejected by the Democrats that control the House of Representatives. We have put amendments forward when we can, when something called a motion to recommit and using devices like that, to continue to ensure that coverage would not be caught up in the question of constitutionality before the court. But what's even more bothersome through this whole process is, you know, if I said to you, Democrats don't want coverage for pre-existing conditions, you would say, well, yes, they have. They voted on it, and it's in law. Well, guess what? It is in law. And besides that, in our bill, we have voted on it, and we have repeatedly said that we are for coverage for pre-existing conditions. Matter of fact, in our bill, we gave that even greater flexibility because some states had very good high-risk programs, better than what the ACA provided. And if someone had a high-risk program, a certain state, Colorado being one of them, I had a very good high-risk program for people with pre-existing conditions that was actually better. And so when the Affordable Care Act went into place for many people in Colorado, they started paying more than they were paying under the Colorado plan. So, you know, you got to be open-minded about this. We got to have non-political talking points and really come forward and solidify a good plan that covers pre-existing conditions and a better health care plan that does things that covers pre-existing conditions, increases transparency and patient choice, and lowers the cost. We all know that the Affordable Care Act did not serve as advertised. People's rates did go up. People did not get to keep their doctor. I remember being in church, and when the priest was making a plea for donations, a woman stood up and said, Father, you don't know what it's like out here. What I'm paying for insurance now with the Affordable Care Act is through the roof, and God forbid I get sick because my deductible is too high. We've got to face the reality that not all people benefit from the Affordable Care Act and that we can do better. So let's sit down in a bipartisan fashion, do exactly that, do better.
Congressman, you are obviously a healthcare professional as well, doctor, and when you were relatively new to Congress in 2013, your office put out a press release about your vote to repeal Obamacare. That's 7 years ago. And in that press release, you noted that at that time, 65% of Americans, according to a poll, did not have a favorable opinion of the law. But it seems like in recent years, people have been more attuned to what they see as a benefit of having protections for pre-existing conditions. And so now the Republican tune on that particular issue has changed. But you have voted to repeal this law outright. And this law...
Well, let's be fair on that. Let's be fair on that. My votes for that were before it was enacted. And when it was enacted, we wanted to replace it. So I think that is not necessarily a legitimate thing to say, because for one, yeah, I did want to repeal a law that I felt was unconstitutional. Think about that law and what it has in it. It has told the American people for the first time that I know of in our history that the government is now telling you are forced to buy a product, And if you don't, then you will be punished, right? That you will be punished. And so what happened? I mean, this is a part that went to the Supreme Court. And when it went to the Supreme Court, Justice Roberts said, well, the law says, the law doesn't say this is a tax, but I interpret it as a tax. And you do have the authority for a tax. But you don't really have the authority to just charge someone, to make someone pay. And so that was the debate then. And really, in my opinion, Justice Roberts, if he said the language was wrong, he should have stuck to his duty in the Supreme Court and not try to legislate from there, but say, I'm going to send this back to Congress and have that change where you call it a tax instead. So there's a lot of reasons why would vote against that to repeal it. But when it was in place, we voted to replace it.
Well, Congressman, let me just ask you this, because you are a congressman and a doctor. And just speaking in general terms, we know that healthcare is expensive in this country, and it is more expensive here than a lot of other Western countries. Do you think that Americans have a right to healthcare?
I think healthcare is one of our highest priorities and always should be. You know,
is it a right? Do you think that people sick, people with cancer, people with any other type of illness have a right to be treated without going bankrupt?
I think everyone should have the right to access to care, and we are a country that wants to provide care even for the most needy. But now you can get into the debate of what something is a right. Typically, a right does not cost somebody else something. And I don't know how you can, as a government official, as a politician, guarantee care when you're not a provider. You know, I think you can only guarantee care to anybody who wants it if you're actually a provider. So what you're saying then is if it's a right, then there must be people that have to provide the care. So now are you going to force people into being doctors? Because that's the only way you can make that a right. And that, to me, does not sound like freedom. Is it one of our highest priorities? It absolutely is. And as a doctor, I want everyone to have access to care. It is one of our utmost priorities. But typically, a right does not cost somebody else something. Your right to free speech costs me nothing. Your right to assemble costs me nothing. Your right to practice your religion costs me nothing. Those are rights that we can guarantee. But no human being can guarantee access to health care if we don't have providers. So how do you guarantee that we have providers? If you put that into the bill, that's a big question that needs to be asked when it comes to rights. But will I fight to make sure, especially as a doctor? I mean, there is no part about me as a doctor that does not want people to have access to care. I can't tell you how many times I had patients tell me that they were financially struggling and I was able to waive their bill. We actually now are in an environment that if you do something like that, you may be in trouble as a physician because you gave someone a special favor. I mean, this is where medicine has gone. And when you talk about the cost of medicine, I could send you a chart that shows you where we have gone with administrators in medicine compared to where we've gone with providers in medicine. We need to be more open and transparent and actually have more of a market where people know what the costs are up front. You know, people will shop for their medicine if you can tell them what things cost. And it's very difficult to do that today. We're in a situation today where patients would say, well, how much will my insurance pay? Oh, well, we would check with them. And the insurance company would come back and say, well, have the surgery first and then we'll let you know. That doesn't help us. That drives up cost. We need for it to be competitive. And we all across the board, and allow doctors to be doctors and let us take care of patients, which is what we always just wanted to do.
Congressman Dr. Brad Winstrup, thank you so much for the time you gave us today. We do appreciate and hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
You bet. Thank you very much for your time. You have a good day.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. And now our conversation with political newcomer Jamie Castle, the Democratic nominee for Congress in Ohio's 2nd Congressional District. Jamie Castle, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Hello, Michael. I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much.
It's our pleasure to have you. And so, Jamie, I read in the Cincinnati Inquirer by our friend Scott Wortman that you were prompted to run for this while you were watching some testimony from someone about the Russian situation in Congress. And you were upset by incumbent Republican Congressman Brad Winstrup's treatment of a witness. And just like that, you became a politician. Is that right?
It is somewhat like that.
Okay.
It was a conversation amongst friends, and we were all discussing what we were watching and listening and seeing. And it was just the divisiveness of it just came off. It just was icky, and we all wanted change. But then a friend recognized that Winstrup did not have a challenger yet and posed the question, one of us should do it. We can do it. We need a candidate. And it was very fast. This was a Sunday. And that Thursday, I was in front of a Democratic Club party here in my neighborhood and introducing myself. I was teaching that week 6th grade social studies during the day. And in the afternoons, I was filing my signatures. And it was super fast.
And you live in Mount Washington?
Yes.
Okay. And this is a district that is drawn in a way that could be very challenging. It does include parts of Cincinnati, of course, but also a lot of the rural suburbs, which can make it quite difficult for a Democrat to run. And you're a Democrat with no campaign experience. How have you gone about building a campaign in this election cycle?
Well, you would think somebody running for Congress would have started a lot sooner and would have had this goal in their life a long time ago. You think of candidates as having a certain trajectory and background. But for me, the situation called for someone to step up, and I couldn't wait for that someone just to appear. It was one of those situations where if you want something done, do it yourself. And I couldn't just wait around for a hero. So this whole time, I knew that the chances would be hard, but I also knew it was a presidential election year and people want a choice and anything can happen. So I never, ever from day one overthought anything because it can get overwhelming. I'm living a very comfortable life of being anonymous, and then I'm all of a sudden in front of everybody, and that can be terrifying. So, but for me, I knew that there was a chance. I knew that we needed somebody like me to step up and look out for people that are not being seen right now. So for me, starting to learn, it was very fortunate in that people who have run in the past came to me with support and mentorship and just leadership all around and friends and new supporters. So I just went with that and took in as much information and guidance as I could. I got a campaign manager right away, so he had experience and could guide me as well. So as long as I was there in the right places and asking the right questions, I felt confident.
Have you been able to get to know the district? I mean, this is a relatively large district, a lot of driving, I imagine. Have you been able to get out and get to know it?
Yes. So for the listeners, District 2 has a portion of Hamilton County that's actually 44% of the population of my district. And people like to say the east side of Hamilton County, but that neglects that little central portion, including Green Hills, where I grew up, and Springfield Townships. And then it cuts down, has the eastern portions, minus Indian Hill. But all of Claremont, all of Brown, Adams, Pike, Highland, part of Ross, part of Scioto. So all the way to Chillicothe, all the way to Portsmouth. And what's fun, though, is that my parents, you know, from Green Hills, retired out to Adams County 15 years ago, and that's still in that district. So I was familiar going into this with that part of our district. And before the shutdown happened, I did travel a lot. I got to the major towns and some small towns and was talking with people. And that was part of the heartbreaking part of it too, because I see so much struggle and neglect, but I also see possibility and potential. So during this whole journey, I did fall in love with District 2. I got to know so much about it and so much of the people here.
We're talking with Jamie Castle, the Democratic nominee in Ohio District 2. She faces Republican incumbent Congressman Brad Winstrup. So a tough district for Democrats typically. You're hoping to change that this year. I noted at the beginning of our chat, Jamie, that you were watching in November of last year the early portions of the impeachment inquiry, and the White House's former top Russian expert, Fiona Hill, was testifying, and you were displeased with the way Representative Winstrup was presenting himself to her and asking questions in a manner that you did not agree with. But let's talk more generally about that. Do you have any concern about the way that process played out? We were talking about something very serious happening in this country, and possibly a quid pro quo between the president and a foreign government, along with that long-standing suspicion and really confirmation that there was Russian involvement in our election process. Does that still matter to people, that very serious issue? Or have you found that people have kind of jumped around from issues of the day, sort of the same way the president does?
I think people are exhausted, Michael. It seems so long ago when you think of the impeachment hearings, and it was less than a year ago, and think of all that has happened since then. But it is important to look back at that time, because the hyper-partisanship that we are seeing right now is hurting everyday Americans. Things are not getting done, and people aren't keeping the executive branch in check. And I think that's what the worry was. Where are the checks and balances? Are people just playing for the party, or are they playing for the country? And people like me worry about that. We look at people losing their jobs because they don't agree with the president, or just all these things with the, now the Supreme Court we have to worry about. It shouldn't be so divided right now. And I feel like that's being played up so much, and it's toxic. People, like I said, are exhausted right now.
Jamie, not only are you a novice campaigner, you're new to politics in this capacity, but you're adapting to campaigning in this pandemic where traditional methods of campaigning really aren't suitable for the times because of the social distancing and the need to transition to virtual campaigning. Let me just ask you generally, how have you been able to adapt to that? Has it been a challenge?
Well, I guess I'm on equal footing there with the other candidates in that we're all navigating this together for the first time. As you said, my district is very large, and I was traveling. It takes over 2 hours to get to the other side from where I live. And so that has been something that has been nice as far as Zoom meetings go. I can meet with more people in one day. I can go from 3 different meetings that go across my district. So that has been something that has been an advantage. I was really looking forward to county fairs and parades and the fun part of campaigning and events and picnics and dinners, because that's the time you really get to be in front of people and get your name recognition. So that part isn't the same with Zoom. We still have house parties. It's so strange on Zoom to introduce me to people, but it feels a little different. We did have a lot of volunteers when the shutdown first happened, that the initial shock wore off and they wanted to get active in the campaign. And so we utilized that time and energy, and they were handwriting postcards for me to independent and persuadable voters. And those will actually get mailed today. We've been saving them up, thousands and thousands and thousands. So that was one thing that, since people had more time at home, we could use that as an advantage too. But yeah, it has been hard for a first-time person like me. Yard signs are more important, I think, too, because people see my name and they're like, oh, that's you. So that's pretty neat.
We're talking with Jamie Castle, Democratic nominee for Congress in Ohio's 2nd Congressional District. She faces Republican incumbent Brad Winstrup. Jamie, what do you think this country should learn about itself from this pandemic experience?
I wrote an op-ed back in the spring, and I said one thing that I think holds true still, that they're going to be studying this year for years to come, decades to come, you know, all the things that happened and mistakes made and lessons to be learned. I think I would never want a pandemic to occur to us, to the whole world, for people to open their eyes to systems that weren't working before, so many cracks in so many systems. And I'm hoping that people are paying attention to all the struggles. And it's going to take a long time, I think, to get out of this. There's so many industries that are going to be affected for a very long time. My big worry is that the divide between people on both sides of the aisle, even we used to watch politics and think, ew, gross. And now I feel like it's trickled into everyday lives. People are losing friends, family is broken up because they don't agree. And it's become, like I said, very toxic right now. And I worry about that. And I'm hoping that after the election, it's going to get ugly. I can see that happening. But I'm really hoping that we can come together and find that really what we want for our country is the same things I see. It's just different ways of getting there. But I'm hoping that we learn that we can't be so divisive.
We saw the coronavirus aid and relief and economic security, the CARES Act, adopted very early in this pandemic by Congress, but we haven't seen much in the way of direct aid to individuals and families since. What do you think Congress should be doing right now as it relates to the pandemic?
They need to be working together. It's very frustrating to see there's a Democratic plan and a Republican plan. We need a plan. And we need a congressional plan, and we need people to come together and put aside any issues that they have. They have a job to do. And that's one thing I look forward to as the Congresswoman for District 2, is working with anyone and everyone to get the important things done for people. Time is so important right now. We cannot wait. there are people struggling out of work, people in the restaurant business, in theater and arts and music. Those things are in a standstill. And we can't wait for these squabbles to unwind. And it's very frustrating from where I see it and where a lot of people see it.
If you're elected to Congress for Ohio's 2nd Congressional District, you would, as we've discussed, represent part of Hamilton County, but also some very rural counties. And in those rural counties, a lot of people have difficulty accessing health care. It may be insurance and economics related. It might be distance. There's all kinds of reasons that people in rural communities have challenges with health care. And yet, according to recent elections, those voters support politicians that seem to want to make it even more difficult for them to access health care. I know that there are health care issues in your campaign plank. How do you overcome that? How do you try to reach those voters who want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, which includes protections for those with pre-existing conditions, which includes opportunities for people who otherwise would not have insurance to get insurance? How are you able to relate to those voters and explain to them the stakes?
It is frustrating. My sister has MS and struggles with that, and she lives in Adams County, and getting access to care is hard. And I worry about her with the pre-existing condition. My opponent did not vote to protect pre-existing conditions, and that's terrifying. I think the main problem is that the Republican Party, number one, they never had a plan to put in place. Once they said, you know, repeal, replace, that never happened. We never got that plan. And it's frustrating, too, that we're just now looking at universal health care as something to look at. We should have been talking about this for a long time. And it's not something scary. It's not this big communist socialistic, you know, thing that the government's going to ruin. It could be amazing and save lives, and it's good for the economy. That's what I say too. Because if you have health care that you don't have to worry about the cost, you can start a small business. You can change jobs. You can leave a bad relationship that was tied to a job with insurance. It shouldn't be this employer-based insurance that you're getting. And now we're seeing too, people are losing their jobs, they're losing their health care. And people need to see the opportunity that can come with universal health care. I think it needs to be done in a way that is responsible and a transition to it, because we want it to work and be sustainable. And I think if we are the greatest country in the world, we deserve the greatest health care in the world. What use is it to spend $700 billion on defense and our military if people cannot afford their medicine here at home and they're sick and dying? So many people are one sickness away from being bankrupt. And it's unfortunate that the people that do get it are the people that have seen that firsthand. And I feel like there's going to be more and more if things don't change. The status quo is not working. We have to get profits out of healthcare, and it can be done.
We're talking with Jamie Castle, Democratic nominee for Congress in the 2nd District of Ohio. She faces Republican incumbent Congressman Brad Winstrup in this year's election. So you're in favor of universal health care, and you said that people would not have to worry about the cost of the care, but the country would. And you talked about a responsible way to do that. What is the responsible way to do that? There's got to be some money to pay for it.
Oh, of course. And this isn't us reinventing the wheel. People have been looking at this for a long time. The Physicians for a National Healthcare Program is a good website to look at. And these are experts in the field. And it's instead of paying your premiums, it's going to be taxes, but it's going to be 95% of the population paying less than they're paying now. So it's really just moving things around. Like I said, you bring in the experts in healthcare and economic experts to the table, and we can figure this out. We're already paying so much money in our co-pays and premiums. So it's just, instead of that, you have something else, whether it's called a tax or a fee, we can figure that out. But like I said, it can be done. I think it needs to be a transition. First thing we need to do is strengthen the ACA so it works better now. And then we can do the option of pay for Medicare for all who want it. Because if there's an option now that's not for profit, that's going to help. And all this time, we can craft a system that is economically sustainable.
Jamie, this year across the country, we've been dealing with a reckoning on race and racial justice, particularly as it relates to policing. And the term defund the police has been tossed around without any precise definition that people can agree on. But do you see a role for the federal government in addressing this disparity in which Black Americans are so frequently killed under questionable circumstances by this nation's law enforcement?
I do, and I do not like the defunding the police phrase. I think it just has so many negative connotations. And me coming from an education background, being a teacher, you know, we've been defunded so many times and trying to do more with less, and that's just not a way to succeed. So I do like the idea of reimagining policing, and I like the community policing. I have so much respect for law enforcement. I feel like there are so many good folks that go into that field. I got to hire some for my church recently when I was president there, when we had security issues, and we hired police to protect us and got to know them very well. And they're good people and they have good hearts and they're doing it for the right thing. Same with being in the public schools. We have resource officers, and the ones I know are amazing people. So I do have so much respect for law enforcement, but I also see the problems that we're facing, and we need to think about and talk about, and we can't be so combative with that as well. People need to understand that you can be anti-racist and want systematic change for justice, and you can be for police. You do not have to pick sides. The police officers that are good and doing it for the right reasons, they're going to want the bad apples taken out too. What the federal government can do is make sure that there are certain things that folks can be accountable for. I would love to see body cams available for police, but we have to give them the resources to pay for that. But also having the system in place where a police officer's record would follow them so they can't get buried away and keep getting hired and doing the same bad things. So there are things that we can do. I think a lot of it is the local control, and you need good culture there and good leadership there. So for people that do vote for their sheriffs, that's something you really want to look at, because that's going to change the whole culture to be more receptive to change and justice.
Jamie Castle is the Democratic candidate in Ohio's 2nd Congressional District. She faces Republican incumbent Congressman Brad Winstrup in this year's election. Jamie, thank you so much for the time you gave us. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
I've been so looking forward to talking to you. As I said, I love NPR so much. And when the primaries were happening and you were talking to candidates, I said, I'm going to have my turn and it's going to be fantastic. But thank you so much for this opportunity. I really do appreciate it.
Up next, I'm joined by WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson, and we'll talk about the state of this race in Ohio District 2. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're joined now by my good buddy, WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. He's on Zoom with us to talk about the Ohio 2 congressional race. Howard, thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Michael.
So a couple of interesting characters here in this race. Mm-hmm. Jamie Castle, a newcomer to politics, motivated to run after watching some questions during the impeachment hearings that started late last year. And Brad Winstrup has a very interesting story, too. Maybe a lot of people don't even remember. He ran for mayor more than a decade ago against incumbent Mark Mallory, who didn't really put up much of a fight against him. And Brad Winstrup came very close to winning. And then he unseats Gene Schmidt in a Republican primary and has held on to the seat in the past four cycles, hopes to make it five in a row. What happens here, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's there's no question this is a very difficult district for Democrats. I think in Jamie Castle, they found probably the best candidate that has run against Winstrup. I mean, the one that, you know, she's totally grassroots. She came up out of the grassroots. That seems to be the case with a lot of particularly women candidates this year. You know, she's a mother. She's a professional. She's got a real passion for it. But, you know, the reality is it's a very tough district for a Democrat. And the reason is because as you talked with Jamie, it's a huge, huge district. And right smack in the middle of it is Claremont County, which is a very large block of very conservative voters, very Republican voters. And that's what saved Gene Schmidt for so many years. And that's what saved Brad Wenstrup. As long as it's that's the case with this district, it's going to be hard for Democrats. Now, Democrats, you know, one thing about this district is retail politics really makes a difference in the second district. Going out to those county fairs and going to the festivals and shaking hands and talking to people. And none of that's been able to happen this year.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that Jamie Castle made the point that maybe the playing field was leveled a little bit in that respect because Brad Wenstrup can't do that either. But at the same time, Brad Wenstrup has a certain advantage in name recognition. He's been around now for a while. He's a longtime congressman, basically, at this point. And she's not. So perhaps, though, she takes a play from the playbook of Wenstrup, who ran an unsuccessful campaign the first time he gave it a shot and then came back and made quite a name for himself.
Well, I think Jamie Castle has at least done some pretty creative things to get around that problem of not being able to go out and travel the district and talk to people face to face, you know, with the Zoom conferences, with the postcards, with all the other social media stuff that they've done. And she's getting some good advice, and I think she has pretty good instincts for it. But it's, you know, like I say, boy, this is a steep hill to climb for a Democrat.
We don't have a lot of time, Howard. And I just want to touch on an issue that am I wrong in finding it strange the way Republicans are now so enamored with protecting pre-existing conditions after all those years that they spent, Brad Wenstrup included, trying to repeal Obamacare without any specific plan to have a replacement piece of legislation that would have protected pre-existing conditions?
No, there's nothing wrong with your perception, Michael. That's it is very odd, but this has been a good district for Donald Trump. Wenstrup has been a pretty dependable vote for Donald Trump over the last 4 years. And nobody in this, or all of the people in this district who supported Trump in the past, most of them are still supporting him, I think.
I've been given a note that we needed to check something that Brad Wenstrup said, that in the new stimulus or the new coronavirus relief legislation proposed by Democrats, he said that Democrats were trying to push abortion access in that. And I'm told that that's not accurate. So wanted to get that out there. Howard Wilkinson, we are going to be talking again all next week. We've got a lot more races to chat about. I know it's a busy season and a very strange time for us to be covering politics, but here we go. And in our last 10 seconds, who won the vice presidential debate last night and why was it the House fly?
It was by far. I mean, there really wasn't that much of substance in this thing. We could have lived without this whole vice presidential debate.
We might be living without the future presidential debates if I'm reading the headlines today. All right, Howard. We'll talk again next week, man. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. This theme music, composed by Rob Fetters. Archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk tomorrow.